The contents of the Egyptian-mediated ceasefire between Palestinian resistance group Islamic Jihad and the besieged Gaza Strip and Israel. Palestinian experts say that the Israeli regime is to abide by the agreement, at least for the time being, but they add that it's unclear how long the latest ceasefire will hold before the regime breaches it. Israel's seriousness will be determined to some extent by the length of the period of calm, they say.
Whether the Israelis are going to commit to this ceasefire, as we know that this is not the first time we have truce or ceasefire. It happened hundreds of times before, and all the time it was Israel who broke this kind of agreement, not just because the Palestinians do anything, but because the Israeli themselves and in this kind of regime, the colonial racist regime, it's used to that.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, during a cabinet meeting on Sunday, told his ministers that the Israeli military took out the entire leadership of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and by doing so fulfilled the goals of the so-called Shield and Arrow operation in perfect form. He also claimed that Tel Aviv had changed the equation and thwarted the entire top of the Jihad movement. Meanwhile, Israel's far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir has demanded that targeted killing be carried out against Palestinian resistance leaders in the West Bank as well. He added that the last operation was good and important, but it must be continued.
The most important thing is that the Israeli regime failed to achieve any political goal, failed in restoring deterrence, failed in oppressing the resistance or creating a fraction between the Palestinians themselves or between different factions. Netanyahu has maybe temporarily succeeded in regaining his popularity. However, he will face his problems within days. This round is failure to Israel.
Analysts, meanwhile, say one of the reasons Netanyahu agreed to the ceasefire is Thursday's controversial flag march that is held every year by the Israelis to mark the occupation of East Al-Quds in 1967 Six-Day War. This annual event has prompted fightings in past years as the Israeli regime insisted not to reroute the flag march away from the Muslim quarter of Al-Quds. Palestinians wonder whether the Israeli policies and killings in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds would affect in a way or another the inevitability of the ceasefire, mainly after Ben-Gvir's call to assassinate resistance leaders in the West Bank. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
From the disgrace of the Nakba to today's resistance. The 75th anniversary of the occupation of Palestine is a time to reflect on the long way the oppressed nation of Palestine has come in its struggle for freedom, while shedding light on the numerous instances of human rights violations committed by Israel in the Palestinian territories.
There are over 1,000 Palestinians currently jailed in administrative detention with no charge or no trial under a Zionist regime that can indefinitely extend their detention, leaving them jailed with no charge or no trial for years on end.
The issue of Palestine is the most important issue in the Muslim world, and Nakba is an occasion for all of us to condemn the atrocities against Palestinians. Resistance is the only way to liberate Palestine.
The Nakba has greatly influenced Palestinian culture, and now a new generation of Palestinians is ready to make the ultimate sacrifice in the fight for freedom.
Resistance has paid off. After years of resistance, now we have reached a point where there is no talk about the Greater Israel Project. That image of an invincible army has been shattered.
It's true that the Israeli regime has tried to create the impression that it's strong. We all know that they have the support of world powers. But today, the regime is facing lots of domestic problems. That's mainly the reason for the escalation of raids and attacks in the occupied territories and the Gaza Strip. It's a way to deviate attention from its internal issues. But the international community is now more aware than before.
Today, the word Nakba and what it stands for is known to all who are preoccupied by the Palestinian cause.
This year on May 15th, the United Nations will be holding a high-level special meeting to mark the 75th anniversary of the Nakba. This is the first time that the international body is marking the date, recognizing the historic injustice suffered by the Palestinian people. Gizumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
It was a gathering of defiance and hope, a chance for pro-Palestinian organizations and supporters to remind the international community they have not forgotten about justice for Palestine. 75 years on from the catastrophe, there was an urgent message for the world.
Today, and our first message is one of solidarity to the Palestinian people, those across historic Palestine from the river to the sea, those in the diaspora. The Palestinians expelled in 1948 and their descendants, who today are marking what happened in 1948, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, the destruction of more than 500 Palestinian villages, but are also marking the Nakba not as a moment rooted in the past, but an ongoing process of colonization, a dispossession and oppression.
Ongoing Israeli aggression and injustices mean the Nakba is not simply a historic moment, but one that demands an immediate response to the current situation.
The Nakba is ongoing, and we have seen the latest threads in that tapestry of the Nakba woven in Gaza, once again suffering the raining of Israeli bombs.
The international community continues to fail the Palestinians, not just for their role in the facilitation of the ethnic cleansing and displacement of the people, but for their continued political blind eye, a blind eye that allows Israel to act with impunity in its subjugation and oppression of Palestinians day in, day out.
Britain's role in not just pushing through the Balfour Agreement, but London's current position as a staunch ally of Tel Aviv makes the demands of the marchers all the more pressing.
What we're asking for as a British public is sanction Israel. We're asking for international law to be upheld. If any other country was breaking this many laws this frequently on an international level, sanctions would be placed upon them without doubt. So we're asking for level playing field here, international law to be applied to Israel, sanction Israel now. The Nakba isn't a historical fact. It's a fact that's going on right now.
We want to see an end to UK-Israeli weapons trade going both directions, actually. It's not just a one-way street. We want to see an end to that. And we want to really call our government to account for its complicity, not only in the arms trade and so on, but the continuing repression within Gaza and within the occupied territories. Really, 75 years is way too long. It's 75 years too long, and we want to see the restoration of freedom and liberty to the Palestinian peoples, to their lands and to their state.
As Palestinians continue to resist the occupation with every resource available to them, those demonstrating are keen to show the spirit of solidarity across the globe remains steadfast. Amina Taylor, London.
Thousands marched in Paris to commemorate 75 years since the Palestinian Nakba, which means catastrophe, the imperialist slaughter and theft by Israelis on a horrific scale in 1948. To achieve their goal of conquering Palestine, Israelis immediately turned 800,000 Palestinians into homeless refugees, used ethnic cleansing to destroy over 400 villages, and massacred over 15,000 people. Since then, Israelis have forcibly displaced a stunning 14 million Palestinians, jailed over 1 million people, and launched an average of 10 police raids every single day. The cruelty Israel has shown towards Palestinians for 75 years has been unending, and the path to justice seems like a long road.
Firstly, it means the end of occupation, because you can always imagine a reconciliation between the rapist and its victim. But this can never happen during the rape. The rape has to cease. And this is the first step.
Even though Muslims outnumber Jews in France by 15 to 1, their support of Palestine is not democratically reflected. Paris has long considered itself as Europe's primary diplomat on the world stage, but many say they do nothing to rein in Israel's daily atrocities and falsely label Palestinian supporters as being against Judaism and Jews.
To label people who defend Palestinians as anti-Semites is a well-known strategy from the Zionist lobby, from the government of Israel, in order to suppress the struggle for sovereignty in Palestine, the human rights in Palestine. Even human rights organizations in Israel are labeled as anti-Semite for defending Palestinian rights and exposing Israeli crimes. This kind of label we cannot accept.
Rarely admitted in the Western media, but common knowledge globally, Israel has turned Gaza into the world's largest prison, where hundreds of Palestinians are murdered by Israelis each year for their land, homes, and beliefs. Israel is currently waging one of its nearly annual wars on Gaza and have killed dozens and wounded over 150 people in the past several days. As many Palestinians remind, the Nakba is ongoing, even if the West would like to ignore it. On May 15th, the United Nations will, for the first time ever, commemorate the massacre, theft, and genocide of 75 years ago. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Only weeks after he said the UK economy might have turned a corner, this announcement by the Bank of England's governor.
But let me be clear, inflation remains too high, and it's our job to get it all the way down to the 2% target and have it stay there. And this is why today we've increased bank rate by 0.25 percentage points to 4.5%.
Since it took measures to tackle the pace of price rises in the UK, the bank has now raised interest rates multiple times, raising questions among economists such as Professor Keith Pilbeam about the efficacy of the move.
Well, today's interest rate rise is just another indication of the failure of the Bank of England to do its job earlier. And had it raised interest rates well before it started raising them and raised them more substantially, we probably wouldn't be headed for even higher rates down the road, and certainly inflation would have been brought back under control.
The rate rise will have consequences, economists say, for other sectors of the economy, such as the housing market, where 2.5 million Britons will soon have to renew their home loans at higher interest rates. For months, increases in wholesale energy prices caused by self-imposed sanctions over the war in Ukraine were blamed for the unbridled inflation here. Energy prices have since eased, but inflation hasn't.
Well, what did Rishi Sunak do when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer? He borrowed well over £300 billion, increasing the fiscal deficit to 15% of GDP. How was that financed? It wasn't financed through tax rises. It wasn't financed through some sort of government cuts or anything like that. It was financed purely by printing of money by the Bank of England. £300 billion in one go, raising the UK money supply from £600 billion to £900 billion in the space of 1 year.
Rampant inflation has seen grocery prices shoot up by up to 20%. The demand for food banks double compared to 5 years ago, and months of public sector strikes for pay rises.
This is the 12th consecutive interest rate rise in less than 2 years, with the Bank of England leaving the door open for more hikes in the coming months. The question now is, when will the bank hit the pause button? Saeed Pariza, London.
Italy's top officials reiterated Rome's full support for Kiev during Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's one-day visit to the Italian capital. On Saturday, meetings between Zelensky and Italy's President Sergio Mattarella and Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni took place amid heightened security measures across the city centre, including a no-fly zone ordered for Rome's skies and police snipers strategically placed on high buildings. Zelensky received pledges of open-ended continued military and financial support by Italy's government.
We are betting on Ukraine's victory. I reiterated to my friend Volodymyr Zelensky that Italy will continue to back his country for as long as necessary. Also, we acknowledge and support Kyiv's European Union ambitions.
Since the war began 15 months ago, Italy has provided over 1 billion euros in financial and military aid, including the costly SAMP-T air defense system, which has for itself a value of around 800 million euros. This, despite polls have been showing for about a year that more than half of the Italians are against sending weapons to Kyiv, and tens of anti-war protests have been staged across the country. After meeting Italy's top officials, Zelensky held talks with Pope Francis. The Holy See has repeatedly offered its readiness to act as a peacemaker in the conflict in Russia and Ukraine. According to some analysts, the Vatican taking the role of mediator is an option that upsets chancelleries of many Western states.
Western chancelleries' opposition to the Vatican working for peace in Ukraine is paradoxical and contradictory. Paradoxical because a ceasefire would be beneficial for all the parties involved, and contradictory because key Chinese diplomats will start touring Europe on Monday. And my feeling is that Western governments will be more inclined to accept China's mediation on the Ukraine crisis rather than that of Pope Francis.
The Vatican is reportedly involved in a behind-the-scenes peace mission, but so far no details have been disclosed. Neither Russia nor Ukraine has confirmed such an initiative. Earlier this week, Pope Francis met with Russia's outgoing ambassador to the Vatican, Alexander Avdeyev. Some Italian media have reported that the envoy may have been given a letter for Russian President Vladimir Putin. Max Civili, Rome.
Hundreds of people attended a memorial service for slain Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. Abu Akleh held an American passport and worked for the Al Jazeera TV network. She was killed by an Israeli sniper on May 11, 2022, while she was covering an Israeli raid in the West Bank city of Jenin. Footage captured moments after she was shot shows her motionless body with another Palestinian reporter being seen next to her. Both are wearing easily recognizable press vests and blue helmets. Since her killing, Abu Akleh has been hugely remembered by Palestinians for her dynamism and courage to cover Israeli crimes. The road where her office was located is now named Shireen Abu Akleh Street.
Every morning we pass by her office to say good morning, Shireen. All our colleagues, including myself, who accompanied her when she was martyred, still think that she is on vacation and will be back to the office.
Shortly after her death, the U.S. government said evidence showed Abu Akleh was killed by an Israeli bullet. But ironically, Washington claimed that it had seen no evidence pointing to her killing being intentional, a line that has also been used by the Israeli regime. Washington also promised an investigation to find out the truth, but a year of U.S. inaction has prompted Palestinians to take the matter into their own hands.
The case has been submitted to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. We're still working to pressure on the Attorney General and the court itself to act and to take a stand in this regard, either by announcing the creation of an official independent international investigation committee or by simply announcing his position.
Abu Akleh was not the first journalist to be killed by the Israeli regime. A report by the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate published in 2023 shows Israel has murdered more than 50 Palestinian journalists in the past 22 years, but the regime has never taken responsibility for any of those killings. Many fear that Israel's impunity only means more Palestinian journalists will be killed in the future.
Israel wants to silence the free speech and the voice of the press, as well as the truth which convey the atrociousness of the Israeli occupation and its crimes.
Even Western politicians who are staunch supporters of Israel are now calling for an independent and thorough probe into the Palestinian journalist's murder. But after so many calls and too many letdowns, many are now questioning whether the situation would have been different if Abu Akleh had not been Arab or Palestinian.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
This one lay.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. 75 years since 750,000 Palestinians were driven out of their country, and at least 15,000 Palestinians had been killed by 1949. The excuse of giving a land without people to a people without land was Zionist and Western propaganda from the very beginning, as this land had been populated by Palestinians for thousands of years. There were 1 million Palestinians living in Palestine at that time. There was collusion between political entities and world media, and a complex and violent project to steal Palestine from Palestinians. And that project continues today to try to legitimize an illegitimate entity as Palestinians continue to resist the Zionists and their supporters. We're going to be taking a look at the 75 years since the Nakba. Today on The Spotlight, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Fra Hughes, author and director, Palestine Aid Belfast, out of Belfast. And Charlotte Cates, international coordinator, Samadun Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network, out of Vancouver. Thank you both for being with me. Well, Fra, let's start off. I mean, if there's one entity more responsible for the existence of the Israeli regime, it would probably be the United Kingdom and its role in the Balfour Agreement and giving land to others which it didn't own. I mean, shouldn't London be held responsible? Are we likely to see compensation coming from the UK for Palestinians anytime?
Well, if we look at the history of the Zionist movement, it was around 1888 that they had their first Zionist Congress in Basel in Switzerland. And they were actually looking at Uganda and Madagascar, and also they were looking at Argentina as possible settlements and colonizations for the new project of Zionism. And like long before the Balfour Agreement in 1917, we had the Jewish National Fund, which I believe was a British-inspired institution, collecting money on behalf of the Zionist movement in order to buy land from the absentee Ottoman landlords. So we can go before Balfour to see a part being played by the British and by the Jewish National Fund. And yes, Balfour did promise the Zionist movement a place inside historic Palestine, while they encouraged the Palestinians to join Lawrence of Arabia and the British expeditionary forces in the Middle East to fight the Ottomans during the First World War. They promised the Arab peoples that they would have sovereignty and freedom, and that they would have their own governments and be self-determination states going forward. And they lied to the Arab people. They lied to the Palestinians. They had a secret agreement, the Balfour Agreement, between Lord Rothschild and Lord Balfour on behalf of the British government. So, you know, after the First World War, they then had the British and French mandate across the Middle East. So while promising people freedom and sovereignty, what they did was they actually replaced the Ottoman Empire with British and French spheres of influence, and they allowed the State of Israel to come into being. So Britain is wholly, not just partly, but wholly responsible for everything that has happened in historic Palestine. All the murders, I believe, that were carried out recently by the apartheid regime in Gaza. And I offer my condolences to those who were murdered and the many others, the hundreds of others who were injured. Britain is primarily responsible for everything that happened before 1948. And America is really responsible for everything that's happened subsequent to 1948. I don't think America, because let's not forget, it's American musicians that are murdering unarmed civilian Palestinians, men, women, and children.
Okay.
It's destroying their homes and their infrastructure. But I don't think the British will pay any reparations.
All right. Thank you, Fra. Well, Charlotte, I want to go back to the end of World War II, because what was said is that millions of Jews had been killed and that their homeland then should be Palestine. What logic could justify that the Germans killed millions of Jews, as they say, but then the Palestinians should be uprooted? I mean, how was it even justified? It's really baffling when we go back and look at this.
Because this is the logic of imperialism and colonialism. It's very clear when we look at the history of Western collaboration with the Nazi regime prior to World War II. It's very clear when we look at the history of Jews being denied entry to the United States and to Canada when they were fleeing Nazism. It's very clear that what happened in occupied Palestine was not a response to the crimes of the Nazi Holocaust. What happened in occupied Palestine was an attempt to use those crimes to instead enact a Western colonial project of destruction and division in the Arab world, and by using the Zionist movement in occupied Palestine. I mean, this was just like today, when we see the German state banning Palestinians from holding protests in Berlin to commemorate 75 years of Nakba and the ongoing struggle for liberation and return, this isn't something that's being done because of guilt over the crimes of the Holocaust. This is something that's being done as an active crime against the Palestinian people, not as any form of reparations to Jewish people. And it's time to put that lie to rest, because the reality is that the Israeli occupation is an imperialist project. It's a Zionist project. It's not a project that serves any form of justice or reparations for any people who have been oppressed in the world.
Well, Fra, I mean, what is it about the Zionists that sovereign countries such as the UK and the US also allowed Zionist terrorists to kill their own citizens to establish or expand the illegal entity of Israel? I mean, we look at the UK and the mandate, when the British mandate was ending, and how British troops were killed by Zionist terrorists. And, of course, we know the USS Liberty, the American ship that was attacked by Zionists, and neither country did anything. I mean, why would they be so subordinate to this entity? Or is it because the entity is serving their interests, which is more important than the people's, their own people's rights?
Yes, if you separate this out into two different aspects, the first aspect is the death and murder of British troops by the Stern Gang, the Haganah, the Irgun, and others. British troops are just purely cannon fodder for the British government and their foreign policy. When we look at how many people died in the First World War in the trenches, they didn't care about sending tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of troops on ill-fated marches across no man's land to be gunned down by German gunners. So the British government cares nothing for British troops. The American state and the American government cares nothing for the sailors on that ship that was sunk, I believe, by Zionist aircraft whenever that was. I think it was the 67 war. Mm-hmm. So when you separate out the people from the governments and you separate out the interests from the elite political class that is in government and that is in hand with corporations and now the globalist corporations that want to take over the world, what we see mainly is that they will use even the death of their own troops in Palestine in 1948 as an excuse to leave in order to create the apartheid state. And America cares nothing for its soldiers who died in Vietnam, for the people who died in Afghanistan and Iraq. They're just cannon fodder. And we see Western governments and the mainstream media continue to define the war in the Middle East along parallels of Israel is this plucky little nation that has its back to the sea, facing a hostile environment of Persian and Arab countries who want to destroy it. That is so far from reality that I'm amazed so many people believe it. But yes, it is foreign policy and the American, British and I include the EU hegemonic machinations within the Middle East and West Asia. Ursula von der Leyen recently said that they made the desert bloom and on the 75th anniversary of the creation of the Israeli state. That tells you everything you need to know about the EU and the people that are running it.
Interesting point. Well, Charlotte, let's talk about the role of the United Nations in trying to legitimize this illegitimate entity. I mean, if we look at 1 year after the Nakba, the Zionists had stolen 78% of Palestinian land. And then in May of 1949, Israel was recognized as an independent state by the United Nations. I mean, what does this say about the role of the United Nations in actually helping to establish and legitimize or try to legitimize the Israeli regime?
Well, it certainly also reflects that history, that these votes largely came before the great anti-colonial movements that won liberation in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And that's one reason why these votes were able to happen the way that they did, because these were essentially votes to legitimize the ongoing process of European colonialism in the Arab world and in the broader region, that essentially the crimes of the Western powers could be covered over by yet more colonial adventures, again, by confiscating the land and expropriating the land while expelling the indigenous people of occupied Palestine. And what we've seen from, 75 years ago until today is that the United Nations as an entity, despite the ongoing voices of many countries around the world, particularly the non-aligned movement, particularly Asian, African, Arab, certainly the Iran, Latin American countries, that what we continue to see is this domination and the use of the veto by the United States in order to prevent any kind of meaningful interaction by the United Nations in occupied Palestine. So today we do see the United Nations recognizing the Nakba. We see, special rapporteurs at the United Nations performing, meaningful inquiries into what's happening in occupied Palestine. But at the same time, the United Nations has never done what it needs to do, which is actually expel this occupying power, this illegitimate entity, from its body. If we're going to say that colonialism is contrary to international law, if we're going to say that apartheid is contrary to international law, then it's time that this so-called state, which is based solely on colonialism, apartheid, occupation, racism, and the dispossession of the indigenous people of the land, is not a legitimate state, is not a legitimate entity, and is something that only exists because it's propped up by $3.8 billion of weaponry given it every year by the United States.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Currently, there are 6 million Palestinians living in the diaspora who either have been expelled from their homes or are descendants of those who have been. 14 million Palestinians in total, many who are internally displaced. Either way, according to international law, expelling people from their homes or preventing them from returning is a war crime. So when do you think we're going to see Israeli regime leaders charged with war crimes? What will it take?
Well, it's never going to happen. If we agree that Israel is a white European colonization of Palestine, let us look to the past. Let us look to America, when the white Europeans went to Canada, when they went to North America, when they went to Australia and New Zealand. They wiped out the indigenous population. They replaced the indigenous population. They said in North America, the only good Indian is a dead Indian. And I see parallels in Palestine that probably the right-wing Zionist Israelis who vote for the likes of Ben-Gvir probably think that the only good Palestinian is a dead Palestinian. You mentioned the UN. There are so many resolutions passed at the UN, even with American vetoes in place, that Israel has never accepted. Resolution 194, the right of return. You mentioned about the displacement of the ethnic population under an illegal occupation. That is in violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. The fact that Israel can murder 33 people in Gaza over 4 days with absolutely no recrimination from any of the Western leaders. In fact, we have the opposite. We have lip service. We have the UN and the EU. We have America and Britain saying we must put an end to the settlements. We must halt the settlement projects. We must step back from the abyss. We must bring people to the table. I know Egypt is permanently involved in the ceasefires that are developed between the Zionist regime and the resistance movements in Gaza. But even then, this all fits into a narrative that suits Israel. They can murder with impunity. And then whenever they need political fig leaf cover from politicians in the West, it is always there. The intention of Israel is to occupy the whole of Palestine, which you can see them doing day by day, incrementally, in the West Bank. And at some stage, they will have either a false flag or they will just, through economic starvation of the people of the West Bank, the occupied West Bank and Gaza, they will try and force the Palestinians to flee. There'd be no war crimes tribunal for the Israeli leaders. If we go back to Sharon, I mean, he was the butcher of Shabra and Shatia in Lebanon. These people have blood in their hands. They have hate in their hearts. And they have greed on their minds as they fill their own pockets with money and try to stay in power, as Netanyahu is trying to do for as long as possible. And I believe the attack, recent attack on Gaza, was to distract the Israeli population from their own internal troubles around these proposed judicial reforms. Mm-hmm. Netanyahu had them hiding in their bunkers so that they weren't at his front door.
Well, Charlotte, Fry was talking about the United Nations and the international community in general, and we saw a few hours ago Mahmoud Abbas addressing the UN on the Nakba Day. I found it quite interesting that nothing was even said about what just took place in Gaza, because we're talking about that the international community hasn't mentioned anything, whatever. I mean, even Mahmoud Abbas, when he was talking about the Nakba on the 75th anniversary, did not even mention that this major situation that has just taken place, and people, of course, are still suffering from the after effects. Let's talk about a little bit about that side of things and the whole Palestinian, because we know with certain aspects of Palestinian leadership, there has been some collusion helping, unfortunately, the Israeli regime. Your take.
Well, yeah, the Palestinian Authority was created as part of the Oslo process. It was actually created to take the Palestinian resistance and liberation movement and instead co-opt it and transform it into a mechanism of repression and security that would serve the security of the occupier rather than the security of the Palestinian people. This is why the basic part of the Oslo Accords is security coordination. That means pursuing the resistance, arresting resistance fighters, and putting them in jail, and pursuing a revolving door policy where Palestinian prisoners are detained in Palestinian Authority jails, only to be detained in Israeli jails, only to be detained in Palestinian Authority jails. And that's not because the PA is kind of a rogue human rights violator. This is the reason why the PA's security forces are funded by the United States, trained by Canada, trained by the European Union, is to serve as a mechanism of security for the occupation. And this has always been the case in colonial projects. projects, there's always an attempt to find a local partner that, in order to serve kind of the interest of a narrow economic class that will benefit from having kind of advantages for capital investment or for profit, will repress the majority of the Palestinian people. And so, you know, the Palestinian Authority's function is to repress Palestinian resistance. But what's been clear in this battle that's taken place over the past week in Gaza is that the Palestinian people are with the Palestinian resistance. And we see that every day in the West Bank. We see that in Nablus. We see that in Jenin. We see that increasingly in more areas throughout the West Bank, is that the PA of quote-unquote security control of these areas because the people are with the resistance. And we saw that in Gaza, where the masses of people celebrated the achievements of the resistance and, more deeply, the assassination of the martyrs of leaders of the resistance who have given so much in the struggle. But despite all of this, despite the creation of the PA, despite the path of Oslo, which we can see that 30 years later is a complete failure for the Palestinian people, it's very obvious, and the resistance continues to demonstrate on the ground on a daily basis, that the only alternative is resistance, revolution for liberation from the river to the sea, and that our responsibility, particularly those of us in Western countries in the imperial core that are providing the money, the arms, the diplomatic, political, military support to the occupation to continue these crimes, is to do everything that we can to shut down the war machine that's attacking the Palestinian people and to extend all of our support as a popular international cradle of the resistance to support those who are on the front lines, those who are defending not only the Palestinian people, but the entire region and all of humanity from the ravages of Zionism and imperialism. Mm.
Well, assassinating revolutionaries and those who resist Israeli terrorism have been a trait of the Zionist regime since its inception. Killing Palestinians who could lead their people's resistance is a modus operandi of the Zionists. But despite this, we see, as Charlotte has just mentioned, strong resistance leadership, more united leadership, and we see now more and more Palestinians actually following the resistance and praising the resistance. Your overall perspective of where this goes from now, because we're looking at, it seems, more solidarity and more effectiveness on the part of the resistance. Your take.
Yes, we can see from the likes of the Operation Room in Gaza, where you have several of the resistant groups coming together to act. Once upon a time, they would only have acted in their own interests, in their own narrow political field. But we can see more and more that if you kill someone in Hamas, or you kill someone in Islamic Jihad, or you kill someone in the PFLP, they are all seeing each other die as comrades and as martyrs. And it's bringing them together in a stronger, more unified bond.
Okay, stay with me, Frank, because I just want to get this last question into Charlotte. Sorry. But Charlotte, despite efforts trying to change the real narrative of Palestine online, there is growing awareness worldwide about Israeli terrorism. Do you think efforts from around the world will ultimately help Palestinians, or do you think the ultimate victory has to come from within Palestine and from the resistance itself?
The victory is going to come from the Palestinian people, from their resistance, from the Arab people, from the people of the region. But the struggle is Palestinian, Arab, and international in nature. And so it can be all of our victory if we all do everything that we can to strengthen the voice of the resistance, to provide the support that it needs, and to make sure that we are doing everything we can to stop our governments from their continuing complicity and participation in these crimes.
And I thank you both for a very interesting discussion. Fra Hughes, author and director at Palestine Aid Belfast, out of Belfast. Charlotte Cates, international coordinator, Samadun, Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network, out of Vancouver. And as always, we appreciate you being with us for another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Hope to see you right here next time. Goodbye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. in the limelight.
Russian tycoon says that dollar has 5 years left as dominant currency. Sanctioned businessman Oleg Deripaska says the greenback has been used as a weapon of retribution for way too long. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, the US dollar has only 5 years left as the principal currency for the global economy, according to Russian billionaire Oleg Deripaska. He claims the greenback superiority has for way too long been used as a weapon of vengeance against all dissenters, and often without prior legal evaluation. 7 years ago, the absolute dominance of the greenback in global settlements and financial transactions seemed unshakable. The founder of aluminum giant Rusal wrote in a Telegram post recently. Deripaska expects global settlements to become more diversified and for digital currencies to become more compatible. He said, "That will be hard at the beginning, but then the world will discover a new reality without a need for a hegemon." Recently, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen admitted that Washington's unilateral sanctions on countries around the world could undermine the hegemony of the dollar. However, a year ago, she claimed the opposite, saying that the greenback didn't have any serious competition and was not likely to for a long time. Earlier this month, Ivan Chebeskov, who leads the Financial Policy Department at Russia's Financial Ministry, said that interruptions and difficulties with international settlements became the most painful consequences of Western sanctions for the Russian financial system. He also highlighted that at the same time, the problem had inevitably triggered an increase in settlements in alternative currencies. In February, the Central Bank of Russia created a special department for handling issues arising in international settlements. The new body deals with the challenges that have become particularly relevant in the context of sanctions, such as the transition to settlements in national currencies. Deripaska is among many Russian businessmen sanctioned in the past year by the U.S. in response to Moscow's special operation in Ukraine. He was forced out as CEO of Rusal after Washington targeted the company's aluminum exports. He's worth $2.6 billion, according to Forbes. Meanwhile, Press TV noted U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has admitted that economic sanctions used against countries by the U.S. put the dollar's dominance at risk. As the United States has continued to weaponize the dollar, countries are seeking alternatives from creating new common currencies to using local currencies. Nations are trying to find a safe and equitable way to trade instead of being at the whims of a hegemony that can decide overnight to confiscate a country's money or cut it off from the international financial system. Russia launched its de-dollarization policy when the West slapped economic sanctions against the country. After Russia launched its special operation in eastern Ukraine in February 2022, the U.S. led a massive wave of financial sanctions against Moscow.
Press TV noted the biggest moves were the decision by the West to freeze nearly half of Russia's foreign currency reserves and also the removal of major Russian banks from SWIFT, an interbank messaging service that facilitates international payments. The backdrop of the sanctions introduced by Western regimes against Russia, a major global energy producer and exporter, prompted China to decide to ditch the dollar in international trade as well. Bank of Russia records show that the Chinese yuan has become a major player in Russian foreign trade. India, a major importer of Russian energy, has also taken several steps towards shifting away from the greenback to rubles and rupees in mutual trade with Moscow.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.